This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture reporting from NPR. I'm Netta Ulaby of NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
As always, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
actress Catherine Keener discusses her latest film, Please Give, her fourth with director Nicole Holofcener.
The adventures of a man who finds his less fortunate doppelganger.
And best-selling novelist Danielle Steele talks about her newest book, Big Girl. But first,
Linda, you were on All Things Considered just a couple of days ago talking about a lightning rod redhead in entertainment.
Yes, I was.
Let's hear you take us through the latest from a once and future talk show host.
Conan O'Brien's contractual veil of silence was lifted Saturday, and his Sunday night appearance on 60 Minutes continued one of television's most remarkable lemons to lemonade stories. For a guy who lost The Tonight Show 7 months after he got it, O'Brien has done just fine. He got a lot of money from NBC when he left. He got boatloads of public sympathy. He's touring live and being greeted like Captain Sully landing on the Hudson. And in the fall, he'll be a highly paid host again on TBS. The obvious question, how do you leave with a payout worth tens of millions of dollars, land a new show right away, and still be an underdog folk hero to many of your fans? For one thing, O'Brien gets sympathy by not asking for it. He insisted Sunday that he wasn't mistreated, as fans often tell him he was. "I'm fine," he told Steve Croft. "It just didn't work out." For another, he balances rejecting victimhood with admitting that it hurts to lose your dream job, no matter how much money you take with you. Million-dollar payouts may not be very relatable to fans, but a toxic work environment, which is what he called it, where you feel unwelcome, that can happen to anybody. O'Brien's smartest choice, though, is holding back, but just barely, about Jay Leno. He declined to answer a question about whether Leno had behaved honorably, but he did say that taking back the show so soon wasn't what he would have done. And he laughed out loud when reminded that Leno sees himself and O'Brien as similarly situated victims of network misdeeds, pointing out that Leno has the show they both wanted while he has his unemployment beard and a life on the road. O'Brien managed to sound self-deprecating while eviscerating Leno's argument. Whether he means to or not, the guy has played the public relations game magnificently from the beginning, right from the moment he addressed his statement giving up The Tonight Show to people of Earth. He's been funny, but he's also sad. And when he temporarily lost television as an outlet, he packed his guitar and hit the road. On his very last Tonight Show, O'Brien begged his fans not to become cynical. He told them, "Nobody in life gets exactly what they thought they were going to get, but if you work really hard and you're kind, amazing things will happen." Since then, he's explored Twitter, met his public in person, and defied expectations by jumping to cable. He sings about being fired, he grows out that beard, and he insists that he's all right. It just didn't work out. It would be cynical to see his rejection of cynicism and self-pity as a public relations gambit. But if they were one, he could hardly have hoped it would go any better.
Thank you very much. It's sounding a lot like a bullfight in here, please. Thank you so much. Hello there. I'm Conan O'Brien, NBC's Employee of the Month. Isn't that nice?
We'll go down to another story of payouts, hubris, and contemporary cautionary tales. This one's set to music. Enron the Musical, recently opened at the Broadhurst Theater in New York on Broadway, it tells the infamous story of the Texas company that went from one of the world's leading energy corporations to a Chapter 11 bankruptcy disaster. Here's reporter Jeff London.
Even if playwright Lucy Prebble is only 29 years old, she adheres to an ancient stage adage, "Thou shalt not be boring."
I suppose it comes fundamentally from this notion, a slightly childish notion on my part, which is, I don't want to write a play about finance that's boring, you know? Because that's what people expect. And also, I read that Enron themselves, they hired Cirque du Soleil to perform at their company parties. I mean, they were not without the flamboyant themselves. So I thought, can we bring that flamboyance to the stage?
Prebble has created a highly theatrical work using songs, dance, and videos alongside convicted felons Jeffrey Skilling, Kenneth Lay, and Andrew Fastow. Director Rupert Gould says Prebble uses just about every device in a playwright's toolkit to bring the culture of Enron to the stage.
It's a play about an accountancy fraud. it needs theatricality, it needs metaphor, it needs big images. And she had stacks of them. And a lot of them came out of Enron itself, which was such a sort of strange and warped organisation, linguistically as well as economically. And so, you know, the Raptors that feature in the show, you know, even the references to Star Wars that we then extrapolate out in the show were very much in Enron anyway.
That's right. Raptors, as in Jurassic Park's vicious dinosaurs, who live in Chief Financial Officer Andy Fastow's office, voraciously eating up Enron's debt, a whimsical embodiment of the dummy corporations Fastow set up to mask the company's unprofitability.
Oh, God! It's the Raptors! You like them? They like you? That's where the debt goes? With these sort of entities? We could never have them publicly at Enron. But LJM doesn't need to show its books, so we can experiment here.
The play is filled with bold theatrical choices, like a lightsaber dance a la Star Wars, when California's electricity is deregulated and Enron's traders jack up prices with disastrous results for the state, but lots of money for Enron.
We got the best business plan with the smartest graduates. Trouble is, right now, we're not making any money.
How bad?
You with me?
Always.
I can't find any area right now except trading. And there, day to day, we might lose as much as we make.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're not kidding?
I am not kidding. Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't mind taking losses. I can't report taking losses.
Preble says she didn't want to go for easy solutions in portraying this story of corporate chicanery.
Yes, there's absolutely no argument that what Skilling and Fastow and Lay, I think, did was terrible and wrong. However, is there also something in us which means that we are bound into this boom and bust situation, that we constantly create these bubbles out of excitement and fervour and then destroy ourselves? And it happens again and again and again. So there's this final speech in the play where Skilling himself talks about that to the audience and in a very challenging way and says, well, it's not just me, you know, it's also you. And you can feel the audience going, oh, I don't quite know how to respond to that.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The play was a hit in London, and the producers hope it will duplicate that success here. She may not make hits, but you might remember Catherine Keener, maybe as Trish, who romances Steve Carell in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, or maybe as the brutally sarcastic Maxine in Being John Malkovich. She's also played writer Harper Lee in Capote and supporting characters in lots of small indie movies over the past 25 years. Her latest film is Please Give. It's the fourth movie she's done with writer and director Nicole Holofcener. Keener plays a New Yorker riddled with guilt about her upper-middle-class life. Melissa Block recently spoke to Keener about the film. In this scene, her character offers her restaurant leftovers to a man she assumes is homeless.
Excuse me, sir. Are you hungry? Would you like this?
I'm waiting for a table.
I'm sorry, I really am.
I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry.
Really, we're very
Please
sorry.
Please forgive me.
Are you out of your mind?
I look homeless.
He looked like a black man waiting for a table.
Let's just say right off the bat that you've buried your head in your hands and you are cracking up at your own lines here.
Well, I'm cracking up at Nicole Holofcener's lines. Yeah. That actually happened to someone she knew.
That somebody tried to give a doggy bag to somebody
yes.
they thought was homeless.
Exactly. And it turned out to be someone waiting for a table.
Well, and that's kind of the nature of your character mm-hmm. in this movie, right? Lots
yeah.
of good impulses that just sort of go wildly awry.
Exactly. Yeah, she's trying to do good. Sometimes you overreach, you know. And it's like a learning process, I think. I think Kate, my character, is in the process of how to balance that. She spends a lot of time feeling guilty about it.
And your character, Kate, feels guilty in large part because of what she does for a living. She and her husband run a vintage furniture store, mid-century
modern,
furniture.
Yeah. So it's kind of popular
right.
and in vogue.
But they're getting the furniture from
dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's take a listen to a scene. This is you and Oliver Platt, who plays your husband, talking about your business that you run together.
People have been coming in asking questions.
Like what?
Like, where does your stuff come from and how do you get it?
you know, people are like that. They're just curious. They're curious about where this stuff comes from.
No, this is different. People who we've bought stuff from are sending in friends or lawyers to find out how much we're selling these things for.
Hun, your guilt is warping you.
Why isn't it warping you?
It is. Your guilt is warping me.
I'm guessing, just a wild guess, that the experience of working on a Nicole Holof Center movie, an intimate thing like this, is just a little different than, say, working on the Judd Apatow movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yes, it's a different experience, mostly because Nicole doesn't have the film that Judd Apatow has to burn. Nicole is, like I said, she's one for economy. Judd, he never really would even say cut. He would just say reload. I mean, we just burn right through a whole, they call them magazines, a film, because everyone was just wildly improvising. It was hysterically funny. Also, you had to kind of lose sense of being self-conscious on that movie because it was sort of an all-in in terms of throwing a joke out, or even the writer would sit behind the monitors, be sit behind the curtain. It was like Oz. I would hear this bellowing laugh, and I knew that, oh my God, it was Seth Rogen. Uh-huh. And at that time I thought, oh my God, I made Seth laugh. That was like, you know.
That's a good day.
That was a good day.
You can hear the full interview with Catherine Keener at npr.org/culturetopia.
We all know this story. A beautiful but overlooked lady somehow draws the attention of some handsome stud. There's hardship, there's travails, but at the end they're all riding off together into the sunset. Now, who would have guessed that super best-selling author Danielle Steele would be the one messing with this fantasy in her latest book? It's called Big Girl, and it's about a young woman who's struggled with her weight her entire life. Michelle Martin talked with Danielle Steele about how she came to write this particular story.
Well, it dawned on me that, you know, not everybody is thin and beautiful and perfect, and that it must be very irritating for women who don't fit the fashion magazine image to always see the beautiful women get all the benefits and great relationships. And I wanted to write about somebody more real who had a weight issue.
Did you have some particular person or scenario in mind as you were thinking about this?
No, but I think it's a big issue in America today. And when you look at the role models in fashion magazines, this is what all women measure themselves against. Most of those girls are very, very young and very anorexic in many cases. And it's not what real women look like.
Has this ever been an issue for you?
No, it hasn't. But I still relate to the problem, and it's I think it's a big problem for a lot of people.
Your protagonist, your heroine, Victoria Dawson's relationship with her parents is critical to this. And I don't want to give everything away, but they are very cruel in their treatment of her. Now, obviously, you know, you're passionate about motherhood and children are very important to you. And I'm just wondering how you imagined them and the role they have played in the life of Victoria, your heroine.
I think that's an important issue, too, of the damage that parents can do to their kids and the messages they give their kids about their self-image and their self-worth, which doesn't always relate to size. In this case, it was an easy thing for them to hang their hat on. But their cruelty impacts her for much of her life, and she deals with it pretty efficiently. But I think that's an issue for a lot of people, too.
You can hear the full interview with Danielle Steele at npr.org/culturetopia.
Linda, what are your thoughts about Danielle Steele's latest novel, Big Girl?
I have often talked on the blog about the fact that I do read a certain amount of romance fiction. I have read in my life a certain amount of it. And this is, I think, new for Danielle Steele and new for somebody as much of a traditional romance novelist as she is. But this is actually something that's been going on for a while with this kind of book.
This being?
With books about women who have weight issues being in romance novels, which in some cases do not require them to become thin in order to fall in love and be happy.
Like Jennifer Weiner.
It goes at least as far back as Jennifer Weiner when she wrote Good in Bed, which has been quite a while ago, and that was a very, very successful book. There's a woman named Jennifer Cruzy who wrote a book called Bet Me, which is fantastic, which is similarly themed. And there's actually a fair amount of this going on. So she's more catching a trend, I would say, than she is suddenly having it occur to her that maybe this would be a good idea. There's a lot of this going around.
We've got another book coming up next. Wes Moore escaped a rough and tumble childhood to become a model of achievement. Decorated combat veteran, White House fellow, business leader. And just after he won the Rhodes Scholarship in late 2000, he also learned about another Wes Moore, a man who would soon be sentenced to life in prison. Michelle Norris spoke with Wes Moore, who wrote a book called The Other Wes Moore.
I was in South Africa, living in one of the townships of South Africa doing research, and I got a call from my mother. And we were talking for a little bit, and she said, I have something crazy to tell you. She said, you know, the cops are looking for a man with your name in your neighborhood for killing a cop. And it hit me. I was like, what? And she said, there are wanted signs all over your neighborhood for Wes Moore. And if you happen to see Wes Moore, do not approach because he's assumed to be armed and very dangerous. That was the first time I really even learned about him. But then as I started reading these articles and learning about this other Wes Moore, I realized that we had so much more in common than just our name. The fact that we both came up in single-parent households, the fact that we both had trouble with school, and the fact that we both had, you know, this, you know, interactions with the criminal justice system, that always haunted me, and it just sat with me for years until I eventually decided to write him that letter.
What did you expect to hear back, and what kind of response did you actually get?
Well, you know, initially I wasn't even expecting to hear back. The day after I mailed that letter, I thought to myself, man, that was a mistake. I was asking what, in retrospect, were relatively naive questions like, you know, who are you? And I was asking questions about his kids and about his older brother, who I knew was also in prison. I was actually a bit surprised when a month later I get a note from Jessup Correctional Institution from Wes Moore. And it was just a remarkable letter where he just literally went point by point answering the questions. And he was explaining to me how much it meant to him that I wrote him in the first place, because he said, when you're behind bars, you believe that no one even knows that you exist anymore.
Now, we ticked through some of your achievements. You have a sterling resume. Perhaps you could, for us, tick through a few of the important milestones in the other Wes Moore's life.
I think there are a few really important milestones. I think, you know, a couple crucial moments have to come down to the first time that he started experimenting and getting involved in the drug life in Baltimore, as he first started, you know, getting involved with the in many ways, the revolving door of the juvenile and eventually adult criminal justice system. The time that he first had his first children when he was 16 and 17, and then two more children at 19 and 20 years old, and the way that shapes your future and affects the way you think about your future and the future of your family as a whole. And after, you know, being involved in drugs and having a chance now to rebuild his life, going to Job Corps, getting his GED, when he came out of that GED program, he was very fired up and excited about life and excited to do things differently, and realized just how strong that calling and how strong that pull back into the streets was, to the point that it eventually broke him.
When you talk about the grip of the street, you often think of this sort of voracious force that grabs young men and women. But in his case, it was almost like he drifted into drugs, mm-hmm. both using drugs and selling them. He saw a kid with a cool headset that looked like something out of a Janet Jackson video and said, ooh, I want one of those.
That's right.
And before long, he was a lookout.
That's exactly right. My mother always says, you know, kids need to think that you care before they care what you think. What Wes saw from the streets and from, you know, the kids on the corner and the kids who were dealing, whereas he saw kids who he felt at that time genuinely cared about him and genuinely cared about his future. And he saw what they had and the material items that they had and how cool they looked. And then you see these kids who are willing to take you in and embrace you as family. What they say starts meaning a whole lot more than what the teachers are saying or what the community leaders are saying. And that's that pull, that's that draw that really dragged Wes in.
Wes Moore talks about his own run-ins with the law in the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Now, it's no secret that we like, when we can, to go out with a little music at the end of Culturetopia. Rock and roll guitarist and songwriter Jack White has been adding chapters to a career that bloomed with his founding of the White Stripes. He produced a Grammy-winning country album for Loretta Lynn and launched two new bands, The Raconteurs and The Dead Weather. Recently, he moved to Nashville and opened Third Man Records. As Craig Havighurst of member station WPLM reports, White's label has gotten praise for being innovative, even though most of its missives are decidedly old school.
In last year's documentary, It Might Get Loud, Jack White says he keeps creatively fit by contriving difficult situations, like wrestling with the shortcomings of a guitar others would discard.
I keep guitars that are, you know, the neck's a little bit bent and it's a little bit out of tune, and I want to work and battle it and conquer it and make it express whatever attitude I have at that moment. I want it to be a struggle.
Opening a record label during a decade-long slump in the music business sounds like the same kind of self-imposed dare. From his new Third Man Records offices in a renovated downtown Nashville warehouse, White explains.
I consider it all an interesting trick, you know, to try to get people to actually buy a record now. It's a positive way of looking at a negative situation. I mean, people aren't buying records like they used to, so it's nice to try to figure out a way to make them do it. I mean, I would enjoy the same thing to own an old movie house to try to trick people into coming in to see the movie, like having 3D or Smell-O-Vision or, you know, Vibro-Vision or something. MacGuffins to get people interested, you know?
The tricks at Third Man include a boutique storefront with Jack White's music and all of the label's records. Every release is treated as an event, and many label events get turned into releases.
This is obviously a stage. I'll show you up here. It might be a little torn apart.
Marketing manager Ben Swank, dressed in a slim vintage black suit and tie, shows off the label's large in-house photography studio. It doubles as a live venue, and a recording booth sits immediately next to the stage.
So every show can just go direct to 8-track.
Make no mistake, he does not mean those ill-fated cassettes from the 1970s. Instead, it's a multi-track analog reel-to-reel tape machine, state-of-the-art for about 1968, with fidelity that some believe has never been surpassed.
And the idea is, if you come to the show, you're then eligible for a limited edition black and blue split-colored vinyl of the show. And then a regular black vinyl will be pressed and sold in the shop and online. But the only way you can get the limited edition version is if you actually come here to the show.
For example, this new release from North Carolina folk punk icon Dex Romweber. It was taped here on a rainy night in February. Then, in keeping with the Third Man quick turnaround philosophy, the record was for sale by mid-March.
We can technically have something recorded and on the street in about 3 weeks. It's kind of a way to make the vinyl more immediate and tangible to kids that are used to just having things right away.
Romweber has also cut a single for Third Man, which marks something of a dream come true for Jack White. Romweber's 1980s band, the Flat Duo Jets, with its lone guitar and drum lineup, was a seminal inspiration for the White Stripes. Growing up in southwest Detroit, White played and produced hard-edged blues and punk rock. He recorded himself and others from the moment he got his hands on a tape deck. Today, he says he's just doing the same thing on a larger scale. He brought another theme from his hometown, where his day job was running Third Man Upholstery with its motto, "Your couch is not dead." Today, the record company's slogan is, "Your turntable's not dead." Third Man hasn't even released a CD and has no plans to. All 36 singles or albums so far have come out only on digital download or vinyl.
Vinyl is the real deal. I've always felt like until you buy the vinyl record, you just don't really own the album.
Jack White.
And it's not just me, and it's not just a little pet thing or some kind of retro romantic thing from the past. It is still alive. I mean, the United Pressing plant is 2-3 blocks away from here, and they're pressing up millions of copies of vinyl every year, and people are still buying them in droves.
Third Man is an auteur's project for sure. Jack White produces all of the releases himself, including this latest music from 72-year-old rockabilly pioneer Wanda Jackson. White says he could tell he was swimming against Nashville's way of recording when he swooned over the first take of Jackson's song, Shaken All Over. The veteran horn players wanted to fix mistakes. He was having none of it.
The more we try to work on this and perfect it, the worse it gets. And that's what happens nowadays with a lot of people working on computers, that they can so easily fix things with their mouse and click on something and erase it and take out all the, oh, somebody coughed in the background, we need to take that out. Or someone hit a bad note. Those are all the best moments. Those are all the best moments. And I think that's where music has taken a left turn and they need to go back, get back on the road, you know?
White's artisanal approach to the record business has been called a throwback and a harbinger of things to come. In fact, Fast Company magazine ranked Third Man among the 10 most innovative companies in the music business. Most of the others were digital concepts with music streaming from the so-called cloud. Third Man's approach is digital where necessary, tangible where possible. For NPR News, I'm Craig Havokhurst in Nashville.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm the other Linda Holmes. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.